Welcome to the latest edition of the Stockyard Sessions podcast from Atlas Ag, the team behind Atlas Carbon and Meyer Grazing. My name is Matt Peacock, and before we introduce our guest for this episode, we need to introduce a new host, and that's Victoria Lawrence, who has been with Atlas Carbon for 7 years, based in WA. Vic, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
So you've agreed to take on hosting duties. That's brave.
I have. I do have very big shoes to fill. I know you've been doing an amazing job. So it is a new endeavour for us. An exciting time. I can't wait to get stuck in.
Tell me a bit about yourself, Vic. What do you do for Atlas?
Yeah, I've been with Atlas and the Meyer Grazing team for nearly 7 years now, and really help producers understand how they can improve their grazing land and their grazing enterprises, livestock enterprises, through different ways of grazing management and how to optimize that to really grow more grass and run more livestock and be more profitable and productive.
So sadly, I am hanging up the microphone on the Stockyard Sessions podcast now. Was it an easy decision for you, Vic, to take this on, or was the hand behind the back slightly?
Oh, look, it was suggested by a couple of people in a meeting, and I did have a bit of a think about it, and I thought, can I do what you do, Matt? It is, like I said, big shoes to fill, and you've been doing an amazing job. So I hope I can do you proud and be able to get the opportunity to talk to some people on mic.
It's a very modest answer. You are an experienced speaker and facilitator and presenter. Look, just a final word on Atlas Ag and your work. Obviously, you've been with the organisation 7 years. What's your view on what Atlas are doing and how you work with producers and how important that is for the wider industry?
Yeah, I think it's an amazing opportunity that graziers have to be able to diversify their income stream with carbon. I mean, we speak to a lot of people who are already really have a view on how to look after their land, how to be more profitable, productive, really understand that soil health is such a key part of that ecosystem on their own farm to be able to build up the enterprise and just the overall profitability of their operation. So to be able to then have an opportunity to earn extra income from that, develop a whole new asset when it comes to soil carbon on these properties is, to be honest, probably not going to be around forever. It's one of these things that is right time, right place for producers to get in and be able to capitalize on improving the soil health of their place, improving how well that they're running their stock, how profitable their enterprise is, and then be able to just put a cherry on top of that with some carbon credits.
Fantastic. So good luck with the podcast. Have you got your questions already for your first guest?
Yep, I'm all prepared, Matt. I really appreciate what you've done with the podcast up until this point, and I hope I can do you proud and you enjoy listening as well on the other side. You can put your feet up now.
I certainly will. Good luck with it. Thank you, Vic. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Matt.
Every grazing system has a story, but most of us only ever hear the ending. The Stockyard Sessions podcast, proudly brought to you by Atlas Ag, is about going back to the beginning. The soil, the decisions, the people who are willing to rethink how things have always been done. My name is Victoria Lawrence, and I'm stepping into the host chair for the first time. And what a way to start. My guest today is someone who doesn't just talk about agriculture. He's lived it, tested it, and repeatedly challenged industry norms. Dr. Alan Williams has worked with thousands of farmers across different climates and systems, and today we'll explore what that experience has taught him, how decisions are made under pressure, which lessons hold true across varying regions and enterprises, and how producers are starting to think about land, biology, and natural capital as long-term assets. Dr. Alan Williams, welcome to Stockyard Sessions.
Thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure.
Well, I know I would really love to be talking to you across the room, but unfortunately we are talking across a big ocean, in fact. So talk to us about where you're at, your home, and what's it looking like in Mississippi at the moment?
Yeah, so I live in Mississippi, and we farm and ranch here. I am actually a sixth generation family farmer and rancher, although the farm I grew up on is in South Carolina, and they've been there since 1840, and I ended up doing a little diversion and a stint in academia as a researcher, university researcher and professor, and that's what got me to Mississippi. I had joined the faculty at Mississippi State University and just never left. So we bought a farm here. And so our conditions this year have been pretty challenging. We were extremely wet in the spring and much cooler than normal. And then it all of a sudden shifted quite radically, and we turned off very hot and very dry. And we ended up by November of this year in a D4 drought. So we went from being way too wet to way too dry in the same growing season. So that's always a challenge when you combine that in the same growing season. But with regenerative agriculture, one of the great things about it, and we can talk about it tonight, is the resilience that you build, that in spite of those types of challenges and those weather extremes, it allows you to be able to get past that and to weather that, so to speak, you know, a lot better than those that are ranching more conventionally.
Well, that leads me into one of my questions in terms of, you know, most farmers or graziers do identify with perhaps a particular type of agricultural system or, sitting under a particular label of how they run their operation. But in your experience, I mean, what are those simple changes that can deliver the biggest wins no matter what their philosophy is?
You know, that's an excellent question, and that's something I had to learn as well. And the very first answer I'm going to give to that is we've got to start once again paying attention to the life in the soil and not just viewing soil as a giant chemistry set or just sterile media that roots grow in. The soil is supposed to be vibrantly alive with far more life beneath our feet than exist above. So that's really the very first place I start now. So instead of looking at my pastures, looking at my cattle, my sheep, other livestock that we have, yes, I look at them and I pay attention to all of them, and we'll talk about a lot of that. But the very first thing I always pay attention to is what is happening in the soil and how much life are we developing there, and are we developing the ability of the soil to function properly? Think of it like this. When you build a house or a building, you've got to first establish a strong foundation, right? And if you don't, that building is not going to continue to stand. Mm. It's going to eventually crumble. So we must think the same way on our ranches and on our farms, that we've got to build that strong foundation first, or nothing else can really be viably and profitably supported long-term without starting with the soil. So that's always going to be my response now, is start with the soil. And when I say that, start with the life in the soil.
I mean, that's a very good segue to talk about starting from the very beginning. When you walk onto a property for the first time, understanding that foundation, I mean, what are the things that you look for to tell you that? I mean, it is very hard to see that from the surface. So are there key indicators that you can walk onto a farm and be able to identify how healthy that system is?
Absolutely. But I'll start with this. There's a quote that I use almost every time I speak anywhere, by W.C. Loudermilk in his book, Conquest of the Land Through 7,000 Years. And the quote goes like this: "The land does not lie. It bears a record of what we write on it, a record that is easy to read by those who understand the simple language of the land." It's very true. The land does not lie. So there are several key things that I do when I step foot on any property anywhere in the world. So it does not matter where in the world I am and what the climate is like. I'm still looking for the same things. I'm going to look at the conditions of the fields, the pastures, the rangeland. How much diversity is out there? What do I see? What kind of stand of forage do I see out there? What kind of diversity do I see in population numbers in terms of beneficial insects, pollinators, and birds. All of those are key indicators. But I never, ever go anywhere without a shovel. In particular, we call them a spade or a sharpshooter. And I always want to look beneath the soil surface. So I always take that shovel and dig in many different places to see exactly what the soil is telling us. And it's incredibly revealing. Once you dig in the soil, no rancher, no farmer can ever lie to us. Once we stick the shovel in the ground, we know what they have been doing, how they've been managing, even for decades, how that land has been managed.
And so I guess on that note, if we're talking about early indicators to tell you that a business is on the right trajectory, so someone who is trying to really lean into that and improve, is there a way to be able to tell that you're on the right path before you can start seeing that in the soil or the pastures?
Yeah, so again, you've always got to look at those key indicators. So if I'm losing diversity in my pastures, that's not a good sign. If I'm gaining diversity, then I'm doing things that are very good, that are going to increase and enhance my resilience, my productivity, the performance, and the health of my animals. That's one of the things I'm going to look for, is signs of increasing versus narrowing diversity. But again, I'm always going to stick that shovel in the ground. And I'm going to be looking for several key things here. Number one, I look at the soil surface. Is it crusted and cracked, or is it very friable? You know, can rainfall immediately begin to infiltrate? Okay. The next thing I'm going to look for as I dig up a profile of that soil is the color of the profile. Is it uniform and is it dark? Or is it dark only in the top inch or two and then it progressively gets lighter? Or is it light all the way through in color? The color of elemental carbon is black. So the darker the soil, the more carbon we are putting into the soil and the more organic matter we're going to have. So we really need to be paying attention to that color profile. I'm then going to look to see, is the soil plated and compacted, or is it aggregated? And if it's aggregated, I'm going to look at the size of the aggregates and the depth of that aggregation. That tells me how well the soil can infiltrate water from either rain or irrigation, and how well it can retain that water versus ponding and pooling and running off or evaporating. So the degree of aggregation matters a lot versus plated and compacted. If it's becoming more plated and compacted and you're losing aggregation, you're going backwards. If you're gaining aggregate, you're in darker color, you're moving forward and you're going to be more profitable, more productive, more resilient. Then I look at the aroma. So I smell the soil. What is the aroma of the soil? That tells me a lot about the microbial profile in that soil. Am I bacterially dominated, or do I have a good fungal and protozoal population to balance the bacterial population in the soil?
I think that's a really important point about, I mean, you would understand us being here in Australia, and like you were just talking about with Mississippi being a really good year and then suddenly turning off and being a really hard year. You're not unknown to the effects of drought, as are we down here in Australia. And it's one of those things that, you know, how can we actually tell that we've still got a functioning ecosystem when we have these hard, dry years? And it, you know, what are the ways that we can really look at that property and not get disheartened that things aren't just going backwards during those drought periods? And I guess soil structure is such a big part of that when it does rain. But then those times when it doesn't rain, how do we really, you know, manage that functioning ecosystem, and what does that look like?
So again, a very good question. And the first thing I'll say, the very best time to prepare for a drought is before it happens, right? Because after it happens, if you haven't prepared beforehand, you're already in trouble no matter what you do. I always, every single year, I graze and manage as if I am going to have a drought. I never assume that it won't happen. I always behave as if it is going to turn droughty at some point. So that means I'm going to graze in a way that I'm always retaining more residual to protect soil temperature and soil moisture, and to protect the soil microbes, and to be able to protect rooting depth and root biomass. And I'm going to make sure that I start that well ahead of when you're likely to turn droughty. In most areas of the world, not just here in the deep South USA, but most areas of the world, weather is cyclical, right? And we know that, but sometimes we don't tend to pay attention to that. So we know when we tend to have wet periods, and we know when we tend to have dry periods. So manage that way. You know, don't, when you get wet, don't manage thinking, well, this year it's not going to get dry. You know, always manage as if it is going to get dry and leave that residual behind. Now, what happens though if the drought becomes greatly extended? And we all have to consider that because it can happen. It happens here. It happens in many parts of the world. And it certainly happens in Australia. What you have to realize there is that if you've done a really good job, you will go longer into that droughty period being much more productive than your neighbors. But even with the very best of regenerative management, if the drought lasts too long, we all get impacted. We have to be thinking about, do we need to destock some to protect, you know, and those types of things. But here is what we have seen over and over and over, is that when we get out of that drought, the regenerative ranches will always respond much more quickly once you begin to get rain again, and they will explode versus the conventional ranches that take a lot longer to recover from that drought. And let me give you a perfect example from this year from South Texas. So I was doing a workshop in South Texas in September, and they had been in a pretty significant drought. The ranch that was hosting the workshop was one of my clients. I've been working with them for about 10 years. They were very conventional before I started working with them. And actually, and they'll tell you, they were very skeptical when I first started talking with them. And as a matter of fact, so skeptical, it's a father and son team that owned this ranch. The son told the father that Alan Williams is crazy. But he said, I'm not going to do what he suggested. That's nonsense. We are not going to do that. But the father said, well, you know, let's just give it a go on a portion of the ranch and just see what happens. You know, and the son said, well, sure, let's do that. You know, and in essence, they were thinking, okay, we'll prove him wrong. And that's okay. I actually like skepticism to begin with. But they did it. It began to work. And, you know, they kept getting better and better at it. And fast forward 10 years to this summer when it was very droughty. And their ranch, in the middle of this drought, the grass was, in a lot of fields that we were going in, was knee-high to almost waist-high in the middle of a drought. All the ranches around them, the grass was extremely short, like tabletop, like a golf course. So basically no grass on the ranches surrounding them, but they had grass. You know, we were walking through knee deep to waist deep grass. All the other surrounding ranches were already supplementing hay and cake and that kind of thing. They were doing zero supplementation. And in the middle of all of this drought, and they're running 850 cows or so, in the middle of this drought, all of their cows were in excellent body condition. The neighboring ranch's cows were getting thin in spite of their supplementation of those cows. They were getting thin. They had a 98% conception rate in the middle of this drought. The neighboring ranches, nowhere close to that. They even increased their carrying capacity 30% during that time period. And they had a neighbor that had a tragedy, and they even took in their cattle during this drought. So they're a perfect example of the resilience and the productivity you can build through regenerative principles and implementation of adaptive grazing in spite of those types of challenges.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those, I guess, myths about, and whatever label you want to put on it, whether it's regenerative, whether it's adaptive, whether it's just planned grazing, it really sometimes can get seen as this is at the expense of productivity or economic viability. And so I think, you know, when people start to look at switching over, that can seem expensive or risky, but really it is a foundation for building a more resilient and therefore a more economically viable enterprise. So what can you talk to about that? And I think the carrying capacity is one major part about that. Obviously conception rates as well in cattle is huge for the profitability of an enterprise. So can you talk to more about the economic side of that?
Absolutely. So let's go back to this same ranch. And again, I'll repeat what I said, but putting emphasis on the economics. And I'll even tell you what the father and the son said at this workshop in front of all the other ranchers. So again, in the middle of a drought, all the other neighboring ranches were feeding. They were not. That's an immediate economic savings, right?
Huge. You're not having to
feed hay. You're not having to feed cake. None of that. Yeah, it's enormous. And it's not just the cost of the hay and the other feedstuffs. It's the cost of the labor and the machinery and everything else to actually go out there and feed every day, right? They weren't having to do any of that. All they were doing was moving a single strand of poly wire. So they had significant cost savings right there. Secondly, like we said, all of their cows were in excellent body condition. They weren't losing body condition. Every rancher knows loss of body condition, you take an economic hit with that. 98% conception rate. Wow. What more could you ask? You know, 2% more maybe, but 98% in the middle of a drought. That's pretty profound.
You'd take that any day of the week, I think.
Any day. And then the last is increasing carrying capacity on the same acres by 30%. That means you didn't increase your cost. You didn't buy more acres or lease more acres. You're not paying more in insurance or anything or taxes. So you're operating on the same acres you already paid for, but you're now running 30% more cows on those same acres. All of that is pure economics, pure net profitability. At the end of this workshop, when we came back out of the field and we all gathered again to wrap up, a number of ranchers in the crowd asked them, well, you really think it's worth it to build your paddocks and to move your cattle as often as you do and all of this And the son spoke up first, the one that, remember, said I was crazy at the beginning and was highly skeptical. He spoke up and he said, I would never not do this again. He said, this makes me money and it takes me less time than the time I used to have to spend before I started doing this.
You cannot get a better testimonial than that, particularly coming from someone who is skeptical. I think it's one of these things that people get a bit nervous to try because what if you fail? And I think in agriculture is one of those industries that really struggles because there have been things that have been done for generations and generations, and you are a bit scared to fail. So I guess, you know, are there any management tweaks, talking about livestock performance, are there any management tweaks that can improve that livestock performance without requiring a total system shift?
Yes, there are. And one of the first things that I always tell people, just start moving them more frequently. You don't have to start with every day or multiple times a day. You don't. But if you've been moving once every few months or once a month or whatever, just start moving every week. It's not that hard. Yeah, and cattle and sheep get used to it really quickly and begin to they know when you're going to move them and they want to move. You know, they always want the freshest forage. So once they learn that you're going to move them frequently, they become really very easy to handle and to get them to do this. That's one of the first things. You will always begin to grow more grass when you move more frequently. That pretty much never fails. You'll always give longer rest periods, which is critical, and you'll increase diversity in what's growing out there, and you'll increase the health of the animals. The second thing, though, is start paying attention to the epigenetics of your animals and start really emphasizing epigenetic selection so that you're saving and selecting animals that really fit your environment, and you're no longer making excuses for those animals that really don't.
Well, talking about animal performance, I know for all graziers, it really is the main KPI and the way that people can see how essentially their asset is performing in the paddock. I mean, what signs tell you that those animals are thriving? Let's just say if we're moving them just even more frequently, can you start to see that in the livestock? I know you said the pastures for sure, but you know, what are those signs that you can actually start to see a shift in the livestock?
Yeah. So in the livestock, you look at a number of things. One is body condition, obviously. Am I maintaining body condition or am I losing body condition? Again, that's a very economically important trait. Secondly, I look at gut feel every day. Am I getting adequate gut feel in those cattle on a day-in, day-out basis? And we look at the paunch area high on the left-hand side of the animal because the rumen's oriented high and to the left. So it's always on the left side of the animal in that triangular paunch area that we look to determine gut feel. Third is I look at their manure, okay? What's the consistency of the manure? Is it very loose and runny? Is it firm and round in shape with a dimple on top? Or is it very dry with multi-layered stacks? All of that tells me a story about my animal performance. So I'm going to immediately look at all of those three things. I'm also going to look at and pay attention to animal contentment. And this is far easier when you're moving them more often. So are they content or not? And that is a key sign in terms of, are they getting enough to eat? Are they doing well? So those are some of the immediate things. But then I'm going to look at, for epigenetic selection, are they resistant to parasites or not? And there are animals that are naturally more resistant and others that are more susceptible. So begin, and if, but if you're mass treating everything, you can't tell that. So you have to stop the mass treatment to be able to visually see who is susceptible and who is not, so I can begin to do epigenetic selection for animals that are more resistant. Same thing with flies. If you'll notice in any herd or any flock, there are always some animals that carry far more flies than others. Well, I want to select for the ones that aren't carrying near as many flies. So I pay attention to things like that. And I even watch how they graze, particularly when I turn them into a new paddock, and what they eat. Those things tell me a lot as well. What are they eating and how are they grazing?
I think you made a really interesting point that I had never really thought about before when it comes to increasing how often you move them. Of course, that comes with a whole host of benefits within the grazing management, but just keeping a view on them and really understanding how they're developing or not, if they are going backwards, because you're just physically looking at them so much more often. You're seeing how they move as well, what kind of species they're going into when they're into a new paddock, what are they going straight for, and really starting to get a much better handle on them as they operate day to day and move from paddock to each paddock. I guess with agriculture, I guess with any industry, there is a lot of conflicting information out there about different ways to do things. A lot of advice. I mean, how can producers build confidence in their decisions in such an environment where there is a lot of different advice and conflicting information out there?
The first thing I'll have to say is stop listening to everybody, because that is one of the biggest mistakes we make, is we seek advice from too many people, too many sources, too many places, and we conflict ourselves and we begin to doubt ourselves. Go back to relying on your own observation. What are you seeing? The bottom line. Are you realizing greater net profits or not? That's an immediate sign whether something is working or not. So we really have to, you know, pay attention to those types of things to know whether something is working or not, and go visit other ranches, other farms, okay, that are implementing the principles or practices that you believe you're interested in, to see how they're doing it and how well they're making it work. Learn about the challenges they had as they made their transition and how they were able to overcome those challenges. So those are some of the key things that I recommend. And again, when you listen to somebody, even me, okay, and I'm going to include myself in that, if we talk to somebody for just an hour at a conference or whatever, you can't tell them everything. You're going to hit the highlights. You can't share all the trials and tribulations and everything you went through. A lot of times people get the idea that, oh, this just works perfectly from the very beginning. There's never any problems or challenges with it. And then when you have the problems or challenges, you begin to think, well, this doesn't really work. They were lying. You always have to remember that. And that, you know, listening to somebody for an hour, whether it's a podcast, whether it's a conference, whatever it is, you haven't learned everything. You know, you still got a lot more you need to hear before you know the whole story, because you can't tell the whole story in a short period of time.
Absolutely. So understanding there is a lot of context and nuance,
yes,
with everything that is being advised in the industry. And I guess that rancher who came to you with that skepticism is almost a good place to be, because you acknowledge that, like you said before, it's something that you actually welcome because you want people to do this their own way, and you need people to have confidence in the decisions that they make. So going in a bit skeptical, but having a try, I think is probably the key to that, and being a bit open-minded in the sense of I will try this and I will test this, and you can just give your experience of what you found, which is really, really interesting, I think. And I guess, how do you see then the role of modern ag tech? Because there is a lot of industries such as Atlas Ag and Atlas Carbon and Meyer Grazing working alongside traditional and observational management as well. So how do those two intersect?
You know, obviously I'm a scientist as well. So what I would say is this: technology can be very good and very useful and very helpful, and it can help us to speed up our pace of learning and even progress, right? But technology divorced from observation, you're always going to go backwards. Never let technology alone take the place of observation. When we do that, that is when we're making a mistake. So the way I view it is, if I'm using a technology that helps me maybe lower my labor requirements or whatever, I'm going to, instead of saying, well, I got more time to stay in the office or whatever, no, I need to spend that extra time that I have out there observing. Let me give you a perfect example. So we've got, you know, the collars now, the fenceless technologies, and there's a number of different ones out there now. I can sit here in my office and on my computer, I can move my cattle or my sheep, but I'm missing the observation. So I would rather move them when I'm out there, have my mobile device with me and make the move when I'm out there, so I can observe them making that move. I can observe the grazing impact in the current paddock. I can observe the next paddock to make sure I am making it the right size, because in the office, I don't know that. And I can see every animal moving by me as they move from one paddock into the other. That is the most important time of every day, is watching every animal move by you as they move from one paddock to the next. Because in a short period of time, I can see every single animal, and I know whether I've got problems or not, and I know how each animal is doing. And I know that in a very short period of time.
So using that technology has really just enhanced that experience rather than completely shifted you away from having to do that. I suppose it's just giving you extra layers of information that you can then use to make better decisions.
Yeah. So with any technology, whatever it is, whether it's the fenceless technology, you know, even the precision ag, you know, and those types of things, you know, they all must be coupled with observation. So with precision ag, for instance, now a lot of farmers do far, far less observation because their equipment essentially drives itself. So they sit there in the cab playing on their devices or watching something on a screen or whatever, instead of observing and paying attention to the fields around them. So they're doing less observation, not more. So you're not learning more. You're learning less. And the more I observe, the more important that data becomes to me.
That's incredibly insightful, Alan. I really appreciate that. And look, I'll just finish with one little question. It might be a deep one depending on your answer, but we're recording this relatively early in the new year, and I am keen to know, what is the number one thing you hope to achieve in 2026? Is it different to your previous years, or is there anything special about this year that you're really keen to see or to do?
Wow, that's a very good question. The number one thing I hope to achieve this year is pretty simple, It's ongoing advancement of regenerative agriculture. And that's in two principal ways: acres or hectares impacted and people impacted. That's how we're going to continue to make things better and better. Continue to get more and more ranchers and farmers actively engaged in doing this. So that's certainly one of the things that I want to see. The second, and I'm pretty excited about this, is we've been working with Dr. Stefan Van Vliet and looking at the impact of this type of agriculture on phytonutrient profile in the foods that we consume. And we're seeing staggering differences. So I want to continue to work in that regard, you know, continue this phytonutrient research and continue to discover how this correlates back to the practices that we're implementing on the land. What are the key correlations between what we're doing on the land and that heightened phytonutrient profile in the foods that we're consuming? Those are two things that I want to continue to progress in this year.
That second one sounds incredibly exciting, and I look forward to hearing how that progresses. And I can just see how passionate you are about the health of soil across the states and no doubt the rest of the world. And Dr. Alan Williams, I am incredibly grateful for your time today and for sharing decades of experience walking paddocks, talking with producers, and learning what really works on the ground. So thank you.
Thank you. I greatly appreciate the opportunity.
And to all our listeners, thank you for joining me for the Stockyard Sessions podcast, proudly brought to you by Atlas Ag, the team behind Atlas Carbon and Atlas Grazing. To learn how you can optimize your grazing operation through better pasture health, stronger livestock performance, and increased soil carbon, visit atlasag.com. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you. Look forward to seeing you here in a few weeks.